listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Eric Liu's book of elegant essays, A Chinaman's Chance, presents the search of ABCs, American-born Chinese, like him, for the place between immigrant parents and their own children. He captures the complexity of cultural identity both on a personal and a global level. He tells us about his 9-year-old daughter, Olivia, a hybrid beauty, he calls her, and how, after his divorce from her mother, he became solely responsible for ensuring she was exposed to and connected to her Chinese heritage. He recounts how that same year, after a trip to China, his daughter decided to go by her Chinese name, Ming, and how, after some time, she casually informed him she'd decided to be Olivia again. The implications, he writes, quote, made me ache with gratitude and grief. He tells us about his paternal grandfather who fought the Japanese and then the communist Chinese and became chief of staff of the First Air Force of the First Republic of China. No pressure, he writes, no pressure. Heritage and identity, he writes, the two are often conflated, quote, spoken of interchangeably but in fact distinct. One is the chrysalis, the other the butterfly, one the seed, the other fruit. The first is insurance against risk, the second is risk. Even if we provide for everyone a usable heritage, we have only barely begun to acknowledge the full flowering possibility of identity, unquote. In short, this is a wise book. Eric Liu's books reflect some of his many interests. His first book, The Accidental Asian, Notes of a Native Speaker, was a New York Times notable book featured in the PBS documentary Matters of Race. He is also the author of Guiding Lights, an official book of National Mentoring Month, and co-author of the best-selling Gardens of Democracy. Eric served as a White House speechwriter for President Bill Clinton and later as the president's deputy domestic policy advisor. In conversation with Eric tonight is another writer who has also questioned issues of heritage and identity in his work, Gregory Rodriguez, publisher and executive director of Zocalo Public Square, our sister organization, I like to think of it. He's also the founder and director of the Center for Social Cohesion at Arizona State University and was for many years an op-ed columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He's also the author of Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, Mexican Immigration and the Future of Race in America. Please join me in welcoming Gregory Rodriguez and Eric Liu to the LA Public Library.
This is your prop, I believe.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Hi. Eric and I are friends and colleagues, so I can't really ask him really uncomfortable questions. I feel my hands are a bit tied. But I want to start off by saying, and trying to embarrass him a little bit, Eric, Yale undergrad, Harvard Law, he's a speechwriter for the U.S. president, and he's sitting here with us, and I told him he should own this building. This man could do a lot of things in his life, and he could have taken his education in any which way, but his priorities are noble. It kind of scares me sometimes. but his interests. I mean, I admire you because you've been in the fray, and you're still part of it. You're very networked. The man knows everybody, but he lives in Seattle, and his partner's an actress. And so I admire you for not having become one of them, and your interest in citizenship and something that we share in redefining America is from out of the best places. So I'm happy and honored to be here with Eric Liu tonight. I'd like to start with why you are so intent on helping Americans. And we'll get to the book in a bit, but why are you so intent on helping and encouraging Americans to think about their country and their place in it?
Well, Gregory, first of all, it's just really great to be here tonight. This is just a spectacular space, and I love libraries. I love public libraries in Seattle. I'm a longtime trustee of our public library and involved now in the foundation for our library, and I just think, as everybody here can testify by showing up here, that these are the seedbeds of citizenship. These are the seedbeds of actually making the idea of self-government, the idea of a republic, mean something other than just mere words. People deciding on a Wednesday night just to come out and meet each other, to hear some conversation, to learn, to challenge each other and to be challenged. It's a great and beautiful thing. And I'm very grateful to the LA Public Library and the Aloud series for having us. And Gregory, we were saying in the green room, I wasn't going to do this too much, but I love this guy, and I think you know.
Stop it, Eric.
Oh, I think you know, if you don't, that this is one of the great civic assets of the city of Los Angeles. Gregory Rodriguez, Zocalo, yes, please applaud, because really bringing a spirit of engagement and conversation and just practical, meaningful ways to reckon with ideas and differing ideas in the city in a way that, frankly, very few people in institutions do. So it's really great to have this conversation. You know, your question, Gregory, I guess there's a couple of different origins of my passion for citizenship and my passion for trying to define and reclaim the idea of America. Probably the most basic, though, is, in fact, being the son of immigrants, being second generation. As I say in the pages of this book, my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, who I never met, and my cousin Jenny is in the house somewhere here as well, our grandfather had the name Liu Guoyun, which for those of you who are not Mandarin speakers, Liu is the family name, and Guoyun means deliverance of the nation, right? So exactly, kind of a pretty intense name, right, to live up to. And he did live up to it in many ways. He came of age as a young man during the period when dynastic rule was ending in China. The Republic of China was forming. He became a soldier. He went into the nationalist Chinese military, helped found the nationalist Chinese Air Force, was a pilot. And again, I never knew him. I only knew him from stories and from this very stern official photograph looking down at me from the shelves of our study. But all through my childhood, I had this sense of Liu's should contribute. And that name, Guoyun, that idea of deliver a nation, be part of the destiny of a nation, was something that really reverberated for me. And for me, growing up here in the United States, I had to realize pretty quickly that this was the nation that I was supposed to have a hand in delivering. I think the seeds were planted very early in that sense. But I think the other sense of just being second generation, doesn't matter whether your grandfather is named Guoyun or not, being second generation and the child of immigrants makes you very conscious, I think, of how every single opportunity you have comes with it, bundled with it, a set of obligations, right? When you are second generation, I won the lottery being born in the United States when I was. I had nothing to do with that, right? My parents bore the sacrifices and the risks of coming here. And other generations bore the sacrifices and the risks that have made this a place where they would want to come. I just won the lottery. And so I have this very acute sense of having won the lottery as a second generation American and being given all of these opportunities just by dint of being alive and awake in this time that I really have to pay it forward, that I really have to earn it. In a sense. And that really infuses my sense of what we're supposed to do as citizens.
I have no doubt that it infuses your sense of what you're supposed to do. We're all supposed to do as citizens. But there is, I have to probe a little bit more, that there is a sense in you that we're not doing something right. There is a sense in you that we're not living up to our obligations as citizens of the U.S. So I like to say, I mean, granted, I'm not going to argue with you in your family history, but there's also some disappointment, I suspect. Or you would not feel, or you would not raise money and go around the country and talk about how we can be more engaged. There's some disappointment there somewhere.
Disappointment is not actually the word I would use. The word I would use is an ambition for redemption. You know, we have in this country a creed, and it's a set of words, and that's basically all we have to hold us together, right? And you who live in Los Angeles feel this more acutely than probably citizens of any other city in the United States. The diversity, the economic disparity, all the reasons why people can find reasons not to know each other, not to be with one another, not to see one another, are very present in the life of Los Angeles or Seattle or any other major American city. And we fail every day to live up to the creed that is the thing that is supposed to unite us. We fail every day to actually redeem the values that are embedded in the Declaration or the preamble to the Constitution or the Gettysburg Address or I Have a Dream or the Seneca Falls Declaration or whatever the kind of text is. There are ideas here. We are dedicated to a proposition, right? That is unique. And yet every day, not just in our history, which we ignore, but every day here, right now, we fail to live up to that. So I don't call that disappointment. I'm not like, oh, America, you know, come on, you let me down here. Like I see that as, okay, now we have our marching orders. Our marching orders, every generation's marching orders, are to close the gap a little bit more between our ideals and our actual institutions, right? Our creed and our actual practices. And the story of America is not a straight line closing of that gap. It's ups and downs and everything else like that. But to me, you know, it creates this urgent sense of our job is to, as much as we can, nudge us into closer alignment.
And where is that gap today? How large is that gap today compared to what it was 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 60 years ago, 100 years ago?
You know, it's funny that you put it in those terms of X years ago, because we're in a season of anniversaries. A few weeks back, I was at a conference and happened to meet on the very day that was the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Civil Rights Act into law. I happened to meet John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, who, of course, as a young man, 50 plus years prior, had put himself on the line in the most visceral, physical way one can to help redeem the creed, right? And you talk to John Lewis and you spend any amount of time in the presence of someone like John Lewis, and you realize two things simultaneously. We have made progress. Here John Lewis stands, an elected member of the United States Congress, a great ally of the first African-American president of the United States. And fill in the blank, every other social fact we know about the incarceration rates of African-American and Hispanic youth, about the economic disparity and the concentration of wealth that are unfolding in this country today at levels nearly unprecedented in the history of the United States, about all these ways in which we continue to fall flat. And so, you know, it's not an either or. It's not, yes, we're doing great, or no, we are an abysmal hypocritical failure. It's both at the same time. We are making progress and we are hypocritical failures. And reckoning with that is, again, what makes me excited as an American. Like it's that tension that gives our life here in this country some juice.
Is the gap between aspirations and reality urgent? You describe it as urgent. Is it particularly dire, the situation? And I mean, usually people try to save things when things are bad. So you're telling us there's always been a tension, obviously, but how bad is it? How much are we? Use the word failure. You won't use disappointment, but you use the word failure. So how big is that gap, and how much are we? How far behind are we? Give us an assessment of where we are as contributing citizens in your mind.
So apart from being a citizenship nerd, I'm a baseball fanatic, and you know,
I would love it if you put it in percentages.
Yeah. Well, anybody, you know, I use the word failure.
Oh, you're a Yankee fan too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Feel free to boo.
Right, bring it on. Bring it on. It's yeah. and my fallback is I'm a Mariner fan, so you can still kind of, you know, give me grief. You know, but as a baseball fan, you know, when baseball players, when outstanding world-class baseball players who, you know, fail essentially roughly 7 times out of 10 at bat, when they fail, they don't talk about it as disappointment, right? They just reckon with the fact of failure. And they learn from the fact of failure, and they're every year trying to edge that percentage up from 260 to 280, 280 to 290, 300 to 320, whatever it might be. And so just on that point about disappointment versus failure, look, I think the urgency point is, while it's true that throughout the life of this country that there's been that gap and that tension, I do think we're in a particularly dire moment right now. And I've referenced it a couple times. We are living through a period of economic inequality and wealth concentration not seen since the eve of the Great Depression, in some ways exceeding the eve of the Great Depression. And again, you all know this. You may not know the statistics, but you all feel it in your bones as Angelenos. You all feel it in the life of what it means to see and be seen and what you're allowed to do and what norms are. In a community like this, that where wealth does matter so centrally. Mm-hmm. I think that's dire because at a certain point, the concentration of economic power becomes so self-reinforcing and compounding that it yields a kind of political power that allows it to reinforce itself and become economic power all over again. And that ultimately undermines the idea, and it's really just an idea, called equal citizenship, right? Equal citizenship, if you really take those two words seriously, where do we actually have equal citizenship? Theoretically, at the ballot box, right? Perhaps, as one of our colleagues here at the library is just on jury duty, perhaps in our potential to be summoned for jury duty. But in terms of voice, in terms of access to decision makers, in terms of power to change the frame of the possible and what goes on in a community's life, we don't have equal citizenship today. Not even close, right? And I think it's dire right now for that reason, because that promise of a republic is being undermined. And at the same time, because of this hugely beneficial thing, which is that we are experiencing a giant wave of immigration over these last several decades, and America is diversifying, and the year 2042 is fast approaching when non-whites outnumber whites in this country, that all of this flux is happening in a way that long-term I think is a great thing, but in the near-term creates intense fear and anxiety in our politics and our political culture. And so we are also in danger of fragmenting that way. And so this is a moment right now where we really have to get to the question, who is us? Who is us? And how do we tell a coherent story about a common story about American citizenship and American nationhood that isn't bound to whiteness and isn't tied to consumerism? Because those have been the two fallback stories for who is us, right? Who is us? An American is somebody white. Or an American is somebody who, I don't care if you're white, brown, black, or yellow, green is the only, color that talks, right? These are the kind of templates that we have for what unifies us. And I think in this moment, it's super urgent that we find or revive another language.
Back to the color green. You muse a bit somewhere, and forgive me, I couldn't find it in the notes. The role of mobility in the sense of belonging. The role of you, and in many ways it may be gratitude, it may be the sense of progress, a trajectory that one becomes part and feels part of the nation, it becomes that their fate is entwined with those around them. As the social inequality, given that we are very unequal, what then, if it's not mobility, what is the primary determinant then of creating this sense of Americanness? And we'll get to your uncles too. Then what is it if we no longer have the sense that we've reached somewhere? If the dream doesn't exist, and by and large it's an economic dream, if that's gone, what is it that keeps us together?
This is a big question, right? I mean, the question ultimately is, what is the American dream? And yes, the American dream, as it's popularly discussed and talked about and understood, is often done so in material economic terms. I want a house, I want this car, I want to be able to take vacations, so on and so forth. And again, what being, in my case, the child of immigrants has always given me is a second parallel, maybe even greater notion of what the American dream is. That it's only partially about economic mobility, that what it is about the opportunity to claim voice, to be able to say, I'm going to tell my story, and my story is an American story. To be able to walk into a space and say, I'm going to walk into the space with this face, or you're going to walk into that space with this face, and people are going to see that and say, that's an American face, right? The American dream for the child of immigrants, particularly the child of non-white immigrants, is to be able to break this presumption that still too often prevails in our society that people who look like this, like look like me, are to be presumed foreign until proven otherwise, right? And so that that dream of claiming, and in the process of claiming, redefining the underlying idea of American, right? So one of the, there's a little interstitial in this book between a couple of the chapters that's just a play on punctuation. And I make a point of saying, I when I say Chinese American, when I identify myself as Chinese American, I do not hyphenate, right? And that is a matter not only of grammatical stricture, but there's a larger philosophical point that I'm trying to make. I say Chinese space American. American is the noun. Chinese is the adjective, right? Chinese is one of many adjectives. It perhaps is central and one of the largest adjectives in my life, but I'm a short American. I'm a baseball-loving American. I'm a politically active American, but I'm a Chinese American, right? And that relationship between adjective and noun is not a static one. The adjective itself, as the adjectives become more diverse, the underlying noun changes, right? It's not that the noun American was this thing that is essentially a WASP male, right? And now you're trying to put a layer of Chineseness on top of this WASP male core. No, we're changing the core, right? That's the American dream, is to change the core, because that is an exceptional thing on planet Earth. One of the things that I say in the book is that, look, there's a lot of anxiety right now about China's rise and about America's sense of relative decline, and whether what that means for our sense of number oneness and our sense of mobility and opportunity here. I don't care how big China's GDP gets. I don't care when that day comes when their economy is larger than ours. Here in the United States, we retain this enduring deep competitive advantage as long as we don't blow it. And that advantage is our recklessly open cultural operating system, right? Our ability to take voices and styles and creeds and cultures and ways of being and behaving and seeing and being seen and fusing them together in all, not in a melting pot that kind of turns them into one blonde, bland, monochrome same thing, but in this kind of converging of streams where new beautiful hybrids are getting created every day. Again, I'm just singing the story of Los Angeles, right? I'm just singing the story of America that way. But to me, that competitive advantage gets boiled down this way. America makes Chinese Americans. China does not make American Chinese. China does not want to, does not know how to, is not wired to take newcomers from other parts of the world and welcome them in and empower them to have cultural and political and civic voice and thereby change the very baseline definition of Chineseness. That is most definitely not what happens in China, right? Now, all of us could go and decide tomorrow we're going to move to China and spend the rest of our days there. We're going to get fluent in Chinese. We're going to learn the culture and the history. We will, even I, ethnic Chinese, will never be Chinese in that sense. Whereas here, that is the point of here, right? And to me, that side of the dream is the side that I really want to nurture, even as, you know, of course, the economic mobility piece is vital as well. But this piece is one that I think is under attended to.
One of the unique things about this book is your willingness to be intimate, your willingness to be I think we saw a little bit of Eric Liu that we never would have guessed before, and there's really beautiful, at the opening particularly, is really beautifully written and very personal. Let's talk about culture as what allows us to survive, which gives us the mechanisms and the beliefs and the sense of our sense of our reality or super reality. And I want to read a passage, if I may. I was going to give it to you, but what the. And I think this is really powerful and beautifully written. When I was a boy and my father was sick, I did not have prayer or church or the organized comforts of a faith tradition. The first time my father was hospitalized, my mother encouraged my sister and me to pray.
We found an old Bible with a thin, flimsy black leather cover that looked as if it had been used by itinerant preachers a century earlier. I still do not know where it came from, but the good book was as bewildering to me then as the Analects of Confucius would be later. It gave no guidance about how to pray in this situation, what to say in the midst of this crisis. So my mother, brave and I realize now so young, simply encouraged us to make up our own prayers. Pray God take care of Daddy, and we prayed together silently. It's not only beautiful, it says so much about you, but it goes on to talk about he between cultures, in a sense. You don't use that word, I don't want to put that in your mouth. But in many ways, you're talking about you weren't Chinese in the sense that your parents were, and you had not adopted certain things of coping. Let's just use coping for the lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. And that you had to learn these things as a second generation. You had to figure out how to survive in this world. And could you talk a little bit about the sort of, and your Chineseness, whatever that may mean, is different at any given age.
Yeah.
And you're right. I mean, studies have shown, actually, ethnic identity can ebb and wane throughout one's life. One identifies differently over time. So tell us about this process of melding or learning how to survive with as a child of immigrants and not knowing what the signs and symbols necessarily were at any given moment.
Well, thank you for that, Gregory. I think that point about your sense of how central a role heritage plays in identity does ebb and flow at different times of your life, right? In my early 20s, when I wrote my first book, it was a period of life where I was very much in the idea of, I'm here to reinvent myself. I'm a blank slate. I'm an American. I'm not bound by this, that, and the other, right? And I question all labels that people want to put on me. And that was the kind of thing that somebody in their 20s might write.
Ouch.
And and here I am now in my mid-40s, and more importantly, not just kind of the accumulation of years, but here I am, the father of a teenager, right? The father of a third generation, ethnically half Chinese, American teenager. And of all those adjectives, of all those words, teenager is probably the most salient one, right? But being a dad these 15 years now has so sharpened my focus, looking backwards and looking forward at just what the dimensions of my Chinese inheritance were that for so long I was not aware of, that for so long I could not articulate, right? And this is a fair amount of what I do try to explore. You mentioned Confucius and the Analects. I didn't grow up in a household where my parents, read to me from the Analects and, taught me the rites as they are laid out by Confucius. I didn't read Confucius until I was in college, and I read it in translation in a course on Chinese history. And yet, now, in this phase of life, looking back, I realize there are so many aspects of the way in which I was raised, and now so many aspects of the ways in which I have formed my own values that turn out to be Confucian, right? That turn out to have, perhaps not chapter and verse, you can kind of, draw it back to this particular piece of the Analects, but even where we were talking earlier, Gregory, my passion for citizenship, my belief that we are not just a collection of atomized individuals ruggedly pursuing our own destiny without regard to each other and bouncing off each other and don't tread on me, I hate that. I hate that story of America, right? The story of America that I believe in is we're all in it together. The story of America I believe in is we are woven into this fabric of relationship and obligation, one to one another as we sit here today, but also to generations before and after, right? The sense of social context, the sense of mutuality, the sense of reciprocity that is many things, the sense that rights are responsibilities, that rights are not just, again, licensed to do whatever you want, that every single privilege we have is a duty properly understood. This is language that is Confucian at its core, right? It is, of course, also, it turns out, language that is to be found in the Scottish Enlightenment and in people like David Hume and Francis Hutcheson, who informed and influenced Thomas Jefferson. And so it is a way to reread the Declaration of Independence to recognize that Thomas Jefferson was himself no atomistic, rugged individualist. He, too, understood in slightly more what I might call Confucian ways the importance of community and context and history and obligation, right? And so being aware of how I was shaped and having that now in turn shape how I move in the world is one example. But I think, you know, the one that you quoted from there, I think goes to another piece of what second generation life is, which is, you know, the phrase I've been using lately, it is beautiful tragedy, right? Immigration and particularly second generation life, trying to make sense of a kind of a foreshortened sense of history and a too blank slate here in American life, making sense of that, there are many daily moments of beautiful tragedy. And so even in that little story there, the tragedy is that in a moment of great crisis and need for coping, I had pretty thin gruel for resources. I had not been raised in a faith tradition that is Western or in an explicitly, you know, Taoist or Buddhist tradition. I was a little bit floating out there, right? And there is degradation of signal and loss and this sense of something's a little bit missing here. Mm-hmm. And yet in the kind of pigeon prayer that, you know, I put together there, there was this spirit that is essentially an American spirit, which is you make do with what you got and you make up stuff with what you got and you improvise, right? And you take you take what you find. I don't know where we found that Bible. And I don't know where we even saw. Maybe we saw it in a little house in the prairie where someone prayed. I don't even know how we learned how to pray, right? That you take what you can in different ways. And there's a certain beauty in that. And I think for all of us, whatever generation you are, is thinking about these moments of acculturation and redefinition. Again, not trying to put the Pollyanna happy face on it. Oh, it's all awesome. We're becoming Americans. But nor is it just about kind of lamenting the loss and lamenting the heritage that is getting growing more and more distant. Like it's a mix at all times.
Let's talk a little bit about this notion you had at 24. How old were you when you wrote that book? The change in your notion of how predetermined or how determinant your ethnicity is. Like you write, for so many years, I have imagined myself as the author of my own story. I have imagined identity to be a matter simply of what I choose to identify with. Like so many Americans, I have cherished the liberty of choice. That has shifted. What other things have you discovered that, my goodness, I've been Chinese all along?
You know, there's a lot in this book about language, about playing with language, about the use of language, about both the Chinese, the you know language, Mandarin, but also the English language, right? And so back to your kind of the season of anniversaries, a month ago, I went out to Normandy, France, to participate in the commemoration of the 70th anniversary of D-Day, the Allied invasion that saved the world, right? And I went there partly because 20 years prior, I'd been involved with the speeches that President Clinton wrote for the 50th anniversary. And so a fellow speechwriter and me and our spouses went back on this trip. And one of the things that trip made me, I mean, it made me realize and reflect on many things, but one thing it made me particularly reflect on was how my own proclivity for speechwriting, for instance, my own ear and instinct for cadence and for rhythm and for the poetry and musicality of language, guess where that came from? That came from growing up in a household of hearing Mandarin all my life, right? That came from having a father who himself was a real sponge for language and loved idiom and slang in every language and loved playing with language in different ways. And he bequeathed to me both this sense that, you know, Chinese is a musical rhythmic language and you kind of internalize this sense of the music of things. But also he brought to it this great playful ironic spirit. The title of this book, A Chinaman's Chance, many of you may know the origins of that phrase going back a century and a half or more when Chinese immigrants first started coming to this country in significant numbers and were laborers doing some of the most thankless, dangerous, life-threatening tasks in laying the railroad or mining our mountains and so forth. And this colloquialism just arose during that age of give these guys the jobs where they have the least chance of survival, a Chinaman's chance of surviving, right? And that phrase itself survived the decades and the generations, such that fast forward 100 years later, when my father came to the United States in the late 1950s, somewhere along the way, he heard this phrase. I actually never talked to him about it. He died many years ago, and I don't know whether he heard it because someone used it to him, about him, or whether perhaps he heard it because, you know, at a meeting or a cocktail party or something, he heard other people saying it just casually, not even paying attention to the fact that there was a Chinese man next to them, right? I don't know how he heard it, but somewhere along the way, he picked it up. And my father's spirit was a spirit of, as I say, playful irony, and a spirit, particularly with regard to language, of anything you want to throw at me like a dart, I'm going to catch midair and I'm going to redirect it, right? And so when I was growing up as a kid, my dad would just use this phrase, a Chinaman's chance, in the most silly, prosaic situations. If the Yankees were down by 5 in the 9th inning, he would say, oh, they've got a Chinaman's chance of winning this game, right? If we were late to the grocery store and it was only 5 minutes to closing time and we were 10 minutes away, oh, forget it. We have a Chinaman's chance of getting there, right? And he would say this in a way to, you know, in Chinese, the word is dou, to kind of to dou me, to prod or kid or try to get a rise out of me, right? And he had this kind of like, huh? Is that, you know, I'm saying something politically incorrect. Are you getting, you know, is that bugging you? And not only did it not bug
was
me.
Was it?
No,
oh, it didn't.
It, not only did it not bug me, you know, what it made me see, although I only appreciate this today, as I basically dough my daughter and prod her and bug her and prod her in the same kind of playful ways, is that he was teaching me ways to reclaim and reappropriate language. That words meant to be used against you, if you take command of them, you can detoxify. And that the act of trying to detoxify those words is itself an act of claiming America, right? And of course, look, context matters. A few weeks ago, a pundit on Fox News talking about hackers from China trying to break into American military systems just blurted out on TV, Chinamen are the greatest threat America faces today, right? A, he used the word. B, he didn't distinguish between, did he mean like people from China or did he mean people like your neighbors, right? He just, you know, Chinamen, right? In that context where, you know, clearly meant with malice, spoken not by someone of the group who has some standing or license to reappropriate it, that's a big not okay, right? When Bob Beckel, the pundit on Fox News, does this. But, you know, what my father taught me was this way of, again, not just with this phrase, this way of playing with language. And that's Chinese, even if my own fluency in Mandarin is not very good. The way that I speak and write English was shaped by my being Chinese.
One of the things I really liked was your consideration of how geopolitics plays a role in the formation of Americanness, or who is considered to be American, and how one acculturates into America. And you write, this sort of shocking to me, this what I'm about to read. The treatment of Chinese Americans has always depended in great measure on the strength or weakness of China. In the 19th and early 20th century, when China was at its weakest, the treatment was at its worst. We are now in the midst of an experiment. What happens when China is at its strongest? What happens, Eric?
Well, I think several things happen simultaneously, and it's up to us, basically, to determine which
I hate
becomes
when he
prevalent.
Does this.
It's up to us. Get used to it. When I talk about citizenship, it's not about some sage on a stage saying X or Y. It's up to us, right? And the two main things that are happening in a moment where China is strong, you know, on the positive side, people are drawn to and attracted to China. And people, I mean, how many schools in the LA area now are now offering Mandarin classes, right? How many people think it's a competitive edge if your kid is learning or can speak Mandarin, even though they're not Chinese, right? There is this sense of there's opportunity there. Certainly there are people in business, in finance, in consumer goods who see this giant marketplace as an opportunity and see these billion of, you know, potential consumers. And so there's a sense of, wow, China's strong and mighty, and it creates more opportunity for us as Americans to engage and do what we do. At the same time, I think when China gets as strong as it's gotten now, and it's only going to be getting stronger in some ways, what also happens is sort of basically a repeat of what happened when China was weak, which is that people begin to otherize China and the Chinese, right? And the simplest way to put it is yellow peril syndrome, right? This country's history has periodic cyclical moments of yellow perilism. And you can see little glimmers of it. You have been seeing for over a decade and a half glimmers of it in American life and American politics. Win-Ho Lee, right? Win-Ho Lee, the American citizen nuclear scientist in Los Alamos National Laboratory, who was an immigrant from Taiwan, who at a period when suddenly the Chinese government was making surprising advances in their nuclear weapons technology, all eyes swiveled to Win-Ho Lee, and everybody said, this guy must be a spy. This guy must be feeding them secrets, because there's no way China could actually get this stuff done, right? And so Win-Ho Lee, at the time, I think a 50 or 60-something bespectacled, frail guy, was put in solitary confinement, 23 hours, in shackles, you know, for basically a year, while the government prosecuted 89 charges of various forms of espionage against him, 88 of which ultimately were dropped, right? There was one charge he pled to, which, of mishandling sensitive documents, but no whiff of actual espionage. And there are moments like this where you suddenly realize, where I suddenly realize, as a Chinese American, that when we start seeing headlines about China's moves in the South China Sea, about how, you know, Time magazine this week has a big story about how China is developing missiles that will sink our aircraft carriers, and they'll push us farther and farther back out of the Pacific. And, you know, you see stories like this, and you hear the sense of threat and menace that's in the air and in the vibe. And what happens then is that, again, what I was saying earlier, I begin to become presumed foreign until and unless proven otherwise, and perhaps even after being proven otherwise, right? And that's a danger that I think, again, we all have to attend to. Chinese Americans, and frankly, all Asian Americans, have the most heightened sensitivity to this for obvious reasons. But this is not a special pleading kind of thing. This is about what we mean to each other and whether we're going to look out for each other when periods of this kind of threat and menace arise.
Add the fact of China's rise, and you, I've been to Shanghai several times, and feeling like an American from Podunk, looking over at Pudong, saying, "Oh my God, they're gonna kick our ass," and not knowing why I said that, and the jingoism, and the sense that we have to be supreme, and then I'd be like shamed, and now I'm confessing to it. Do you hear?
I like that, by the way, from Podunk to Pudong. That's good.
That's going to be my memoir.
Yeah, that's good.
So add China's rise and the fear and the hysteria that is likely to continue. I'm much less hopeful about anything than Eric. The fact that Chinese Americans have the highest incomes and highest levels of education of any ethnic group in America, that's generally a recipe for resentment and scapegoating. It doesn't bode well. How do we keep this? I know you're going to say it depends how we play it.
No.
What do we need to do? I don't see, you see it here. Wall Street Journal did a great series several years ago on Anglo upper middle class parents moving their kids out of the Cupertino schools because they didn't want to then compete with the Asians. I mean, we're going to see growing resentment in Miami. What do we do to stop it?
I will get to what we do to stop it in 1 second. I promise I will. But the thing that I want to...
You promised.
I think I want to say just prior to that, though, is a particular instance of what you're talking about. This fear, not exactly scapegoating. I mean, scapegoating is definitely a possibility. But there's also another thing which happens already, which is what I think of as damnation by high praise. The model minority stereotype, right? Or in its most recent incarnation, the tiger parent phenomenon. Right? To me, the whole tiger mother, tiger parent thing was this fascinating kind of window into the American id, the American psyche, because it wasn't just about Amy Chua and her over-the-top self-caricature of her parenting stories. It was about this sense, akin to what you felt standing there in Shanghai, looking across the Pearl River at Pudong, the sense of, oh my God, these Chinese parents in Cupertino or in my neighborhood or whatever, they're insane. They will make their kids practice 10 hours a day. They will set their kids' stuffed animals on fire if they don't practice 10 hours a day. And I can't compete with that, right? I throw in the towel. This is they're so good and so dedicated and so, insanely focused on achieving that the rest of America is toast, right? This was this thing that was in the air that was partly about, again, scarcity mentality and status anxiety in an age of inequality, because people feel like there are fewer slots to opportunity than there used to be. But it's also, again, in the shadow of China's rise, this sense of Chinese everywhere, Chinamen everywhere, whether in the Cupertino schools or in Beijing, are about to eat our lunch. And so what we do about that, I think, is severalfold. Number one, what we do is we keep open eyes and open heart. And when you have open eyes, what you'll see are a few such things. You will see in January on ABC, on the ABC television network, a new sitcom called Fresh Off the Boat. Some of you may have heard of this. Fresh Off the Boat it's a sitcom based on a memoir by the celebrity chef and restaurateur Eddie Huang, right? Son of immigrants from Taiwan. And he wrote this memoir, this very irreverent memoir about growing up the son of immigrants and how his way of trying to push against that tension of being second generation was to try on various identities of being a pothead, being a jock, being a gangster rapper, all these different things until finally, into his 30s, I think, he realized the thing that I am and love and am best at and can bring to the world is actually this particular inheritance from my Chinese heritage of I'm awesome at cooking Chinese food. Right. Then his path flowed from that forward. He wrote this great memoir, which now is going to be a sitcom, the first sitcom about a Chinese American family ever, only the second ever on a Asian American family. Some of you may remember 20 years ago, Margaret Cho starred in a sitcom called All American Girl. Right.
I have to interrupt you. You were never a stoner. Were you?
I not only never inhaled as a young person, I never even lit up. So.
Okay. Go on.
So suddenly we're going to start seeing, as we're flipping channels, we're going to start seeing Chinese-American family, a Taiwanese-American family, right? And that's going to be a new way of thinking about kind of goofy dads and sitcom families and set-piece funny situations that happen on TV, right? Then you're going to go to the bookstore and you're going to see a novel called Southern Cross the Dog, which some people have praised as the great Southern novel of the last few decades, written by a recent graduate of an MBA program, an MFA program at Hunter College in Brooklyn named Bill Cheng, right? A Chinese American who essentially just never been to Mississippi, but just imagined himself, immersed himself in the life and the cadence and the language and the rhythm of the Mississippi Delta right before the flood, right, of 27. And he wrote this fantastic novel. And you think, that's interesting. That's another way of being Chinese American, right? Then you'll look around, and you'll go online, you'll decide to buy yourself some new shoes, and you'll go to Zappos.com, right? And you'll realize, oh, Zappos.com, yeah, that thing was founded by another son of immigrants from Taiwan, a guy named Tony Hsieh, right? Who embodies this fusion of Chinese and American kind of cultural identities. He's American in the sense that he's the heroic dot-com entrepreneur who defied all the naysayers and sold shoes online when everybody said, no one's going to buy shoes online, they want to try them on, right? Well, several billion dollars later and an acquisition by Amazon later, he's sitting pretty as an entrepreneur, but he's also now investing $300 million of his fortune into revitalizing downtown Las Vegas, where he has moved his company's headquarters. And downtown Vegas, as you may know, is kind of the dilapidated part of the city off the strip, which is a civic desert in the midst of this actual desert. And what he's doing with this money he's investing is to create a community, investing in arts and in startup incubators and bringing young people and bringing diversity to that community, which is this great thing that is both Chinese in its kind of communal focus and very American in its belief in the power of diversity and imagination and creativity. That's another way of being Chinese American, right? So our culture is changing all around us. And even as all of this menace and all of this danger unfolds, more and more Chinese Americans are claiming America. And as long as all of us, whether we are Chinese or not of ethnicity, see and embrace this, you know, I still do have cause for optimism that we are going to be moving in the right direction.
I have about 17 more questions, but I'm 4 minutes over time. So thank you, Eric. I'm going to ask the applause before we go to Q&A. And we will be taking, Eric will be taking questions.
Great, we have one right here.
Okay, I have to qualify Berkeley and Harvard. Berkeley undergrad, Harvard grad, USC professor in architecture, finishing a film called Face of a Nation, documentary about the erosion of America's image in the decline of our presence at world fairs. Question. Mm. We've got this problem of the way the rest of the world relates to us in terms of our image. You crossed into a lot of areas that I want to continue to ask you about at some point, but we've got this immigration problem. We have our image being eroded as we've become known as warmongers. How do you perceive how to, or at least maybe there's somebody out there that's going to define another American way of fixing this image of our country?
That's a great question. I'm super interested to learn more about this film project that you're involved in. I want to tell you a story about a friend and something of a mentor of mine from Seattle named Gary Locke. So as most of you may know, Gary Locke was most recently the United States ambassador to China, the first ever Chinese-American ambassador to China, right? Prior to that, he was commerce secretary. Prior to that, he was a two-term governor of my state, Washington State. And prior to that, he was a kid who grew up in public housing in Yesler Terrace in Seattle, who was an Eagle Scout and just this all-American kid, right? And when Gary Locke was appointed ambassador, it was very interesting to kind of follow the arc of how people, not only around the world, but particularly in China, reacted to this, right? The first reaction was something reminiscent of when a bunch of years prior, when he was governor, he made his first trip to his ancestral family village in China, and that was in the mid-late 90s, and he was treated like a hero, right? Chinese state media just, it was like a rock star treatment and just huge parades of people waiting on streets to wave at his car as it drove past. And so when he became ambassador, nearly 20 years later, initially there was the same kind of adulation, like, okay, this is history making, someone who's Chinese, who will get us, right, who understands us, is coming to be ambassador. And what quickly happened was that people in China, both everyday people, but particularly the leadership, the state, came to realize that the job of ambassador from the United States to China is not to be friendly, warm, likable, ethnically relatable dude. The job is to represent the interests and values of the United States, right? And when those interests and values of the United States come into either tension or conflict with the perceived interests and values of the People's Republic of China, turns out that Gary Locke was fearless about doing his job, right? He was fearless about engaging with Chinese dissidents. He was fearless about pointing out the levels of smog in Beijing and the kind of hazards to health about pollution that China itself was not really wanting to admit to its own citizens. And so he created this sense of resentment that came from the top down in China, so such that by the time he left his job as ambassador, an organ of state media, and again, it's worth pausing for a minute when you think about which of our countries is more nimble and adaptable for the long term, I place my bet on the country that does not have state media, right? But an organ of state media, as he exited his job as ambassador, wrote this editorial that basically lambasted him and said he was terrible and for the kicker, called him a banana, right? And this banana meaning yellow on the outside but white on the inside, right? And you know, I bet the person who wrote that editorial, you know, in some organ of Chinese state media bureaucracy thought, I'm pretty hip. I'm using this kind of American race insult.
It's so, right? 1975.
Exactly. Yeah. But they still thought they were pretty hip. But to me, it just revealed this incredible poverty of vision, right? Because their use of that word, saying that when Gary Locke is representing America, he must be white inside, says to me that China just doesn't get what we all get, that to be American is not to be white anymore, right? That to be American is to be something else, and that Gary Locke, as much as any human in our country, actually embodies that something else, right? And so, you know, when it comes to our image, I think about the image that Gary Locke embodied and represented is exactly the image I want. Somebody who fuses different aspects of heritage to form his own identity. He's not a fluent Chinese speaker. He's not, you know, he himself would admit all the ways in which he is lacking in his kind of practice of heritage. And yet he also has been shaped in these deep ethical ways in thinking about family and obligation and right as duty and responsibility to the greater good and the collective, that he would identify as Chinese, right? That's an image that I think is awesome, right? And not just to show to China, but to show to the rest of the world. And so I think the way we address this is we get more Americans who don't look like Bill Clinton or Mitt Romney to be our ambassadors. And I don't mean that in the formal job description sense of a member of our diplomatic corps, right? I mean just our faces and our voices in the media, in education, in academia, in film, in popular culture, in politics, so that more and more people around the world realize, wow, okay, yes, America has been for the last decade, making war where war wasn't necessary. America has all these flaws. And yet, if you are a fourth generation ethnic Turk in Germany, you are still a Turk, right? You are not German. And not to pick on Germany, that's true in nations all around the world. Gary Locke, as a second, third generation Chinese American, is distinctly, uniquely, beautifully American. And that's an example I want to show the rest of the world times a million, right? Okay.
Hi.
Hello.
Good to see you. Do you think that civic apathy, perhaps best quantified by lack of voter participation, is the disease or the symptom? Hmm.
It's a symptom that becomes a disease, and it's a disease that becomes a symptom, right? In this sense that and Debbie is one of the people in this country that actually give me hope, kind of, you know, rising generation people who are applying their smarts and their talent and their expertise to be thinking about how do we revitalize civic life? How do we use technology and media to revitalize and rekindle civic life? And how do we do things in a new way? And I think that the underlying disease is that people feel like the game is rigged. And if the game is rigged, why bother? Right? Why bother? And so voting in that sense is a symptom. But where not voting becomes an actual disease is that we forget here that not voting is voting. Not voting is absolutely as much voting as walking to City Hall and dropping a ballot into the box. Not voting is voting to give more power to people whose preferences are inimical to your own interests, right? It is actively handing over the key to the car that's going to run you over, right? Not voting is voting. And so when you, out of a perhaps justified sense that the game is rigged and, you know, everyday Americans don't have a chance against cronies of both parties and inequality has made it such that only, the 0.1% actually ever get heard and their petitions are the only ones that ever get answered. When you have that sense of hopelessness and stop voting, it becomes a deeply, quickly self-fulfilling prophecy. Right, which is why I actually think, and again, I'm influenced by having spent some time with John Lewis lately, that for all of the newfangled ways that we can think about trying to revitalize civic culture and citizenship in America, the most basic one is right under our nose, right? The most basic one is what people, again, got their heads cracked, their bodies hosed down, their lives put at risk, their lives ended to give us, which was the franchise. The franchise is sitting right there. If 100% of eligible voters actually voted this November, we would have a peaceful revolution, right? That would suddenly make you realize, holy cow, like the game doesn't have to be rigged. This is a whole other thing. This is my Chinese communitarianism, I guess. I'm for mandatory voting. I don't think voting is a, we are citizens of a republic, not just a democracy. This is not just a plebiscite democracy where we get to do American Idol and pick contestant one, two, or three, right? This is a republic.
We're in California now, so.
Yeah, I know.
A little different.
Washington too, but, direct democracy has its place, but we're a republic, and that means we have to govern ourselves, and that means we actually have to show up in a way. And by the way, this is a message for everybody, but, my message for Chinese Americans in particular, and Asian Americans as well, is it is time for us to show up in politics and civic life in a big way, in every way you can. And if your interest is in running for office, great. If your interest is in organizing other people, great. If your interest is in making films, great. Like, start shaping the culture of our politics, because that's the only way our politics is going to change. Thanks, Debbie.
Thank you. I just am reading a book of the collection of letters that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams exchanged, basically telling the story of the American Revolution, the intellectual aspects of it. And it seems to me that what you're saying this evening really could be said by these two gentlemen as well. In fact, they did say it. And I see this as a, even though you are speaking in some sense more toward your personal experience, I see this as the current or a current reincarnation of that American dream of trying to find a voice as Jefferson and Adams and the leaders of the American Revolution did. And I don't find it so different. In fact, I find it very refreshing that, in fact, it seems to me you are in that same line trying to come to a realization of what it is we can do to move or keep that dream alive.
Well, thank you for that. That's very, very high praise in the sense of, I was telling Gregory earlier this afternoon, I went to visit the Skirball, Cultural Center here in Los Angeles, which many of you may know is this great, iconic, beautiful campus, essentially, whose origins are kind of doubly in education about Jewish heritage and identity and education about democratic heritage and identity, right, in America. And that's, it's the same thing. That is another variation on the same theme, right? If the theme was laid down by Jefferson and Adams and others of that generation, then everybody since is doing variations on the theme, right? And the thing that I would add, though, and this is something that I really believe just as fervently when I talk about being second generation. So I'm literally second generation in the sense of son of immigrants. But I submit to you that every one of us here is second generation. Every one of us here bears far more connection, not actually to Jefferson and Adams and the people who were the revolutionary generation, the people who did the Big Bang, right? The founders and framers. Like, they are rightly, treated as once in an eon kind of group of humans. What we bear a greater relation to, actually, is the generation that followed, Daniel Webster's generation, the first generation to grow up in the United States as a free and independent country, right? Because Daniel Webster's generation basically had to answer the question, okay, you won the lottery, how are you going to earn it, right? Okay, people fought and died and did great deep debates about the meaning of freedom and liberty and self-government, and now we've handed you this thing. How are you going to not mess it up? And every generation of Americans since, whether your family goes back as far as those founders and framers or whether your family got here last week, bears more relation to that second generation of Americans, right? And that keeping that second generation spirit alive of both we inherited something and we both have to and get to fulfill it and redeem it on terms that are authentic to who we are now, right? And if who we are now, it means we are Jewish as well as Anglo, WASP. And if who we are now means we are Chinese as well as Jewish and WASP. And if who we are means we are Hispanic or Mexican as well as Chinese and Jewish and WASP, then all the better, right? But that spirit of second generationness is something that I think we all have to really kindle and hold on to. Okay.
Over here. Move to the right over here.
Thank you. I've noticed that often parents will try to prepare their children not for the life that the children will have, but for the life that their parents had. And I would love to hear a little bit of how you find yourself parenting your child similarly and differently to how you were parented.
Great, great question. I am, one of the ways in which I feel very blessed is that my parents were very atypical immigrant parents. My parents were totally not tiger parents. And that was partly by temperament. It was partly by how, particularly in my mother's case, she had been raised. She herself was the only child of an idealistic young academic, a professor of European history, who was teaching at the time when, again, like my paternal grandfather, at the time when dynasties were ending, republic was forming, and he was part of this what's called May 4th reform movement. That had a new vision of China modernizing and westernizing. And so my mom grew up in China and Taiwan, hearing a lot from a father who basically said, you know what, forget all this kind of ancient Confucian stuff. Forget all of these traditions that have held us back. Like, we gotta mix it up, right? My mom read Russian novels as much as she read Chinese classics as a kid. And I think that shaped a bit of her sensibility when it came time for her to parent me. And so... She was very untiger in the sense of she and my father made me do absolutely nothing. Really. I mean, they set an expectation that was really, I mean, when I think back on it, never voiced, but I felt it all the time, that you should work hard and you should excel and you should be all you can be. And if you're not, you are a disappointment. Right, that's where that word, you know.
I love that. That word's always going to associate.
but what they, you know, it wasn't just pure laissez-faire. When they saw that I was intrinsically motivated to be into something, you know, violin or drawing or something, then my mom would pour it on. Then she would, you know, oh, you like to draw? Let's go get on the train. Let's go to New York. Let's go to the Metropolitan Museum. Let's go see Cézanne. Let's go see Degas. Let's go see Rembrandt, right? And she would pour it on that way. And I would say that I am a parent in a similar mold, right? Whatever the taxonomical opposite of tiger is what I am, right? And yet, from the vantage point of my teenage daughter, you know, she often says, half jokingly and half with an edge, stop being so Asian, stop being such a Chinese dad, right? When I am trying to make her, you know, do a little bit more, push herself a little bit more. But in general, I'm similar in the sense of, you know, let's get down to something concrete, which is how I'm trying to teach her Chinese, right? So my Mandarin is proficient at best. I could chit-chat with you, but I could not be doing this conversation in Mandarin right now. My reading and writing are nearly completely, you know, fallen apart. And I was, you know, I went to Chinese school as a kid and I paid, you know, some attention. And there's a line in the book that those who ignore Chinese school are doomed to repeat it, right? And I am now repeating the experience trying to get my daughter to go to Chinese school. And for many years, she hated it and resisted it. And I kind of had to sympathize because the schools were very stultifying and boring. And as she said, kiddie, right? Too juvenile. And so I said, I'll make you a deal. We won't go to Sunday Chinese school anymore if once a week, you and I have a tutorial. And somewhat to my surprise, she took me up on the offer. And for the better part of the last 5.5, 6 years now, most Tuesday afternoons, we will spend an hour or 2 hours in a Chinese tutorial, right? Now, is that enough to get her to fluency today? Not even close. But what it has been enough to do is lay this foundation such that You know, Olivia has, again, she couldn't carry on even chit-chat probably in Mandarin, but what she has are instincts about Chineseness, about Chinese language, that are in turn instincts about Chineseness. She has instincts about the right order of strokes when you're writing a character, right? And this is of great consequence when you write, when you learn written Chinese. It's not just however which way. There is a proper order to the strokes. So the fact that there is a proper order, and the fact secondarily that the proper order goes from outside to inside, from context to the inner pieces, is itself saying something, right? She has an instinct about spoken Chinese, about the right way to structure sentences. And Chinese is a language that is very, in a sense, poetic, because there are few prepositions, there are few verb tense variations, and so you have to get the meaning of a Chinese sentence mainly by context, right? And she understands this. And so my job, I feel like, as a non-tiger dad, is not to be totally laissez-faire, it is to give her enough access to this so that when the day comes, hasn't come yet, when the day comes when she really intrinsically gets motivated to go deep on this stuff, that she'll be able to, that she won't be starting from zero, but that she'll in fact be starting from a much greater inheritance than other Americans who are starting from zero. Like, that's my job.
She's a Mariner fan.
She's a fan of whatever dad's a fan of in baseball. So.
Last question, right over here. Hi, thank you. There's a general view that Asian Americans and Chinese Americans are politically apathetic a bit. And could you talk about your views on what you think the sources of that are? And how do you think that can change in terms of increasing engagement in the Asian American community?
Another great question. I think the sources of that are fact. I mean, lots of Chinese and Asian Americans are politically apathetic. The sources of that, I think, are, you know, there are lots of reasons speculated. I mean, some of it has to do with people coming from countries and situations, if we're talking about Asian America generally, where to be involved in politics or in government was literally a life-threatening endeavor. And so the habits you learn are habits of keeping your head down and staying out of the mess and keeping your opinions to yourself, lest they be used against you in the most severe ways. I think another, you know, source of this political non-engagement is simply the realization for a lot of, again, Chinese and more broadly Asian Americans, particularly of my parents' generation, right? It's, again, it's less true today. My daughter's generation is the most diverse and multicultural and mixed race generation in the history of the United States. But when my parents came to the United States, there was still this sense that people with Chinese faces and Chinese accents and Chinese, you know, who were visibly immediately identifiable this way, were always going to have a disadvantage in realms where it was about the intangibles, right? The intangibles of, does this person have the right stuff to be promoted? Does this person have the right stuff to be, you know, a leader, to be chosen to do this thing or the other? And so they gravitated toward fields where progress and achievement were quite tangible, right? Fields in science and mathematics and the like, and engineering, which tend to lean you to steer you away from history or law or politics or things like that, where it's about subjectivity. It's about how somebody is seeing you. It's about how well you can make your case, you know, in a public arena. And so I understand some of those reasons, but here we are now, right? And the urgency that I think is that I feel so strongly is that Chinese Americans have to, as I said, really commit themselves. And I'm not just talking about younger generation Chinese Americans. For all of you who are, you know, the generation of my parents, or between my age and my parents, or older than my parents, it's on you too. It's on you and up to you also to either give permission or to model it yourself, that you're going to start raising your hand in public, that you're going to start making your voice heard, that you're going to start challenging public leaders on things that you're not sure you agree with, that you're going to start organizing and participating, that you're going to just start joining clubs and associations and being part of civil society in a way that's not just about the enclosures of our family, right? And you know, one of my heroes, who's my age peer, I think she might be younger than me, someone I write about, another daughter of immigrants from Taiwan, a woman named Ai-Jen Poo. Ai-Jen Poo runs a thing called the National Domestic Workers Alliance, which is essentially an entity to organize nannies, home care workers, caregivers for the aging, right? Ai-Jen, on the one hand, is, you know, cut out of a mold of a classic American labor organizer. She's fearless. She's feisty. She'll go in there and she organizes people in this beautifully American way. Her workforce that she's trying to organize is incredibly multiracial, right? It's mainly non-white, but it's every form and flavor of non-white that you can find in the world. But at the same time, she's not just taking this kind of clashing oppositional view of an labor organizer trying to bash employers. She's also got this kind of Chinese spirit that has led her to create a thing called Caring Across Generations, this campaign that's getting people to reflect on ways in which an aging, largely white population is going to become ever more dependent upon a younger, non-white generation of caregivers. And that it behooves all of us on both sides of that equation to empathize with one another, to build relationships of the heart as well as relationships of the wallet and employment, right? And to me, the spirit of cross-generational understanding is just such a powerful and beautiful thing. And Ai-Jen Poo's example is exactly what I want to see more of. You don't have to run for office. You don't have to be in elective politics. You can just be in public life trying to make a difference for other people and bringing the full complexity of your authentic self to bear in how you do that job. And I think when we do that, then, you know, at the individual level of Ai-Jen, you are, you know, in kind of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you are practicing kind of full self-fulfillment. But what you're really doing is you are delivering on the promise of the nation, right? You are actually living up to the destiny and the promise and the idea. And that's what we all got to do.
Before we give him a nice last round of applause, Chinaman's Chance, fantastic book. Pick one up on your way out.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, man.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.